Cradio, nourishing the soul of the digital generation.
Sam Clear is a Tasmanian-born Catholic who, inspired by a desire for Christian unity, made a 15,600-kilometre journey on foot through South America, Central America and North America, across Siberia by train, and on foot again from Moscow to the most western point of Spain. He now shares the story of his epic adventure with people around Australia and has just released a book entitled Walk for One through Garrett Publishing. This is the first part of our two-part interview with Sam about his journey across the world and beyond.
Welcome to Cradio. This is Natasha D bringing you an interview with Samuel Clear, adventurer, speaker, managing director and author. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you very much. Great to be in here in the studio.
All right. Now, you are an intrepid adventurer extraordinaire with a missionary heart, inspiring tens of thousands, I think, worldwide. Now, some people have heard of you, and that's fantastic. But for those of our listeners who are hearing about you for the first time, tell us a little bit about you and the walk that you did.
Okay, my background, I originate from Tasmania. I live here in Sydney now, but I grew up in central Tasmania and had a very outdoors kind of upbringing. In fact, despite having a degree in mechanical engineering, I went through my entire schooling and university without a computer. I was very happy to be out on my parents' farm, to have a mountain bike or a kayak, and simply to be active. That's really all I was that interested in. I grew up with a faith. I had always wondered, though, how my greatest gifting, which was sport, and that's what I excelled at.
I believe.
I played AFL reserves at Collingwood and Western Bulldogs. Retired when I was 19, though. I played representative cricket and athletics. But it was one of those things where I really thought I'm not going to be able to offer God that much through my giftings. As it was, though, once I graduated from university, I joined Youth Mission Team Australia. I did 1 year in Sydney, involved in youth ministry. I loved it so much, though, that I didn't ever go back into the engineering field. I stayed on 2 years in Adelaide and 2 years in Melbourne. During those latter 4 years, I was the manager of the youth mission team, and I started to be invited into different meetings as a Catholic representative. And so often in these meetings, they were looking at different ways in which the wider church could outreach, either on mission or in ministry, such as evangelization. And I was there as the Catholic representative, but so often these meetings descended into playground fights when they found out where each other went to church. In fact, one meeting stopped when they found out that I was a Catholic. They actually asked me to leave, citing that it was supposed to be Christians only, and they apologised that I had accidentally been invited. And I started to meet people who, because of the church they went to, they'd lost friends and family. I was fairly regularly under attack, and I don't mean simply people took objection, but they really were going on the front foot to make their objections known that I was basically an evangelist in high schools, but I was Catholic and working with a Catholic organisation. And we tended to come under fire a lot. And there was no, I think what struck me was that there was no willingness to actually dialogue, to talk something through. In fact, one particular guy who was trying to evangelize me, in inverted commas, every time he put an argument forward and I gave a response, he refused to acknowledge my response. He'd simply move on to the next argument. And this kept happening time and time again. It was becoming very regular. And then the clinch moment was I read a book by Patrick Madrid called Surprised by Truth. And it was actually Surprised by Truth Volume 2 that I read. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, I think. It was reading some of those stories and seeing the hardships that some people went through when they made a conscious decision to become a Catholic. I think in that moment I caught a glimpse of the body of Christ being the church being broken again, only it wasn't the Romans who'd crucified him, it was us. And even if we were apathetic towards it, we were allowing it to happen. And I couldn't let go of it. I actually headed off, this was on a Sunday, and I headed off to Mass that day And the gospel reading was a man finds a treasure hidden in a field, goes away and sells everything that he owns and comes back and buys that field. I'd heard that gospel passage many times before.
But I believe this day it really resonated with you at a really deep level.
It hurt. Yeah, and I couldn't let go of it. And, yeah, in the end, the only response, I hadn't studied theology or philosophy, and I really had no idea how I could respond to this particular call. In the end, though, the two great loves of my life, adventure and God, amalgamated into a missionary idea, which was to sell everything that I owned. My faith hero was St. Francis of Assisi. So to follow in his footsteps a little bit and to sell everything.
Big
sell
footsteps everything. In which to follow.
Yeah. It was only for a short period of time. I'd love to be able to follow in his footsteps for my whole life. But this was certainly just a moment of my life. But sold everything and decided to walk around the world on foot, praying for unity, stop in every single church I pass and invite them to pray for unity. And I set about five people further down their faith walk than myself, one of them being now Archbishop Christopher Prowse, who's now in Canberra, but he was in Melbourne at the time as an auxiliary bishop, and made the deal with God that if he could get all five to say yes to this harebrained idea of a missionary trip, then I'd do it. And all five said, yes, we need it, go for it. In fact, Bishop Prowse at the time actually met with me a couple of times and helped me to put the missionary structure together, what the journey would look like.
Okay. So here we have a mechanical engineer from a farm in Tassie, AFL player, loves his sport. He's about to embark on an adventure, walking around the world. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine you might have had some naysayers, some people, what are you doing, wondering what your motives were, are you serious, are you really going to do this?
To be honest, I didn't get a great deal of that. I was really surprised. I thought that I was quite nervous to tell people what the plan was. Once I'd done about 6 months' worth of research and a lot of prayer and come to the conclusion that, yes, I was going to do this and really felt that God had blessed it through a number of different means, I was really nervous to tell people. I was really surprised that people's reaction to it was actually one of excitement. And I think that might have come about because I'd had a very different upbringing and most people were very aware of that different upbringing. I think the fact that at the time I was riding an 1100cc motorbike, I had my Land Rover Discovery, I'd head back to Tasmania. I was living in Melbourne at the time, but I'd head back to Tasmania regularly, out onto the farm, go mountain climbing. I think for most people it wasn't as big a step as it would be for your average city-dwelling person to make that decision.
Okay.
Of course, my mum and dad's reaction was a little different. Dad was very practical. He simply shrugged his shoulders and noted that it was a very long distance and I better make sure I've got some good gear. Mum, however, was very concerned. She was the most concerned of anyone. She desperately wanted to know who was walking with me. How do we get in contact with you?
Where you'll be?
Where will I be? I had an itinerary for the entire journey for all 568 days. That wasn't for me. That was for Mum. That was so that if they didn't hear from me, if I disappeared off the face of the planet, literally, they knew where basically to look.
That's a good son. If you let your mum know where you are, that's a good son to do that.
Well, I tell you what, she's a good mother too, because I know a lot of people who they wouldn't be allowed to. Quite seriously, their mothers would put their foot down and say, no, you're not allowed. I've got plenty of friends who just wanted to go away and do very safe missionary work, and they literally were not allowed because their mothers said, no, you have to get your university degree, you have to get married, you've got to wreck your financial future. So I'm still indebted to my mum for, despite the dangers, for actually letting me do it. In fact, I think the very first thing Mum said to me when I told her was, I always suspected you'd end up doing something as stupid as this. But there was a resignation to that and to letting me go.
Let's talk a little bit about this walk. Now, calling it a walk is a bit of an understatement. 568 days, and there's varying kilometerage taken by foot. It's over 15,000 kilometers.
Yeah, 15,600.
15,600 by foot, everyone. Mm-hmm. That's by foot. So you started.
There's about another 20,000 not by foot.
Yep.
You know, in air flights,
in Siberia,
and boats, on the train.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, one side of the Atlantic Ocean to the other. But I obviously didn't head across the Atlantic Ocean. I headed the other way.
Okay. Very good. Now, some people have heard your story, but for people that haven't, can you please tell us? I mean, there's so much in 568 days, so many amazing accounts, surprising encounters, things that happened, being holding at arm's length a Russian by the throat in each hand, being held by gunpoint, being touched in the heart by meeting Adolfo and his family, and the extremes of the trip. You've seen both sides of humanity, the beauty and the not so beautiful side. So I'd like to give you the opportunity to tell us a bit about your journey and to feel free to share some of the things that perhaps you haven't shared before that you'd like to.
Look, it was the journey itself was an extraordinary glimpse of both unity in action and the disunity that has just, I guess, spread out across the world, and the brokenness, not just of the church, but of society, of our world. A very difficult journey. I was pretty ignorant to that, and I think I needed to be. I did think that the journey would be, to put it in a very simple term, cool. I thought it would be a great journey, and it was going to be a lot of fun. I thought it's going to hurt physically walking that distance, but I thought that the rest of the journey would just be a great adventure. I did not, out of ignorance, I didn't account for the difficulty of passing through some of these countries. Found myself at gunpoint three times, robbed at knife point by four men and stripped clean of everything that I owned. As you alluded to, ended up in a fight with two guys in Russia where I ended up with both men around the throat, holding them at arm's length, trying to stop them from beating me up. Was chased down the road by two men in Belarus, one with a knife. I was hospitalized many times, salmonella poisoning, typhoid fever, food poisoning four times, and numerous injuries. I had surgery at one point on my big toe without anesthetic because it was so badly infected that the anesthetic just wouldn't distribute properly. I was arrested on a number of occasions. So much verbal abuse. It's not funny. And it was never really because they knew what I was doing. It wasn't because I was a Catholic walking for the unity of the church. It was usually because I was a white guy. It was usually racially motivated. So it was the first time in my life that I had experienced racism, which was really difficult. I really struggled with it. It ate at me for the first few months until I was able to, I guess, accept some sort of, reasoning as to why they were yelling that, and to a point, forgive them and just keep walking and not take offense to it.
I particularly liked one novel approach that you had to this these racist taunts was the universal language of football. Tell us about that.
While crossing the border from Guatemala into Mexico, I walked past a semi-trailer and ripped my shirt. There was a bit of wire hanging out off the trailer. It hooked on my shirt and ripped it. I only had one spare at that stage, so I wanted to get a replacement shirt. This hole was getting bigger. So after all the verbal abuse I had encountered, I hatched the plan of they have a name for people from the United States. They call them a gringo. So I wanted to un-gringo myself. So I walked into a sports store and I had a chat with the young guy working in there and said, I want to un-gringo myself. And he laughed at me and I said, I want to wear a soccer shirt. And he nodded in agreement and said, yeah, that would help. I said, what have you got? And he pulled out two soccer shirts, the Mexico City Pumas and the Guadalajara Chivas football shirt, which is a red and white striped shirt. And he said, these are the two we have. And I said, which one do the rural people follow, the lower socioeconomic people? And he smiled and pointed to the red and white striped Guadalajara Chivas soccer shirt. And he said, we all love to see Guadalajara beat the rich Pumas. So I said, well, I'll take that shirt, please, and put on my red and white striped Guadalajara Chivas soccer shirt, and walked on the next day feeling I felt odd wearing this soccer shirt as I walked on down the road, but I hadn't gone too far and a couple of men stood up at on the veranda of their home and yelled out to me, said, "Hey, gringo!" A very aggressive tone, and I turned expecting the worst, and the guy thrust his fist in the air and said, "Guadalajara Chivas, yeah!" And they all clapped and applauded, and I picked the emblem up off the shirt and kissed it and waved goodbye to them, and they applauded me on down the road. So it's funny, the soccer shirt did come to my aid. It helped greatly. I wish I'd thought of that a few thousand kilometres previous to Mexico.
It was a stroke of genius, I think.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us about some of the other encounters. You were travelling along the road, I think, with two Irish guys, one of whom had not prayed a lot for a long time, and there was a snake involved. Tell us about that.
This was brilliant. So I walked this is on the Camino de Santiago in Spain. This was my final home stretch. I'd walked about 14,500 kilometres at this stage, and suddenly I meet up with hundreds of pilgrims, all in their brand new walking gear, and my walking gear is being held together literally by fishing line and sticky tape. I had this masking tape holding it together.
Use the engineering term from your blog, stuffed.
Stuffed, yeah. Everything was stuffed at that point. And I walked on along the Camino, meeting some wonderful people. It was an extraordinary debrief for me to walk along the Camino, meeting these people. And there were two men in particular that I became good friends with, a fellow called O'Sheen and another fellow called Pat. They were both from Ireland. They didn't know each other before. We actually ran into each other on the same day. And we'd been walking along for about 2 days, chatting away and catching up. And eventually I noted to them that, look, this is great. I'm really enjoying talking. But I said, I'm not doing what I would normally do, which is walk and pray and intercede for unity. I said, do you mind if we spend a bit of time in prayer? And they were both all for it. In fact, one of the guys, Pat, noted that he hadn't prayed in about 20 years, and he said he'd love to. So we opened up in prayer. We prayed a decade of the rosary, and then we spent a little bit of time interceding. They were both married men with families, so they were interceding for their families. And at the end of this prayer time, O'Sheen accidentally stepped on a snake in mid-conversation, and he saw it just as his foot came down on top of it. So his full weight went on top of it, and then he has hopped and skipped away from this death adder as quick as he possibly could. And he was he really didn't like snakes at all. So he was backing away flat out. He injured the snake badly. It basically split the side of the snake open. So I said to the guys that I'd put it out of its misery. And so I just lowered my foot down gently on top of its head. It was moving back and forwards, but staying in the same place. So I lowered my head down and literally crushed the serpent's head. And Pat piped up at this point in his Irish accent and said, guys, this is really significant. He said, I've prayed for the first time in 20 years, and now we've just begun talking about the significance of prayer, and we've crushed the serpent's head. He said, we all have to jump on the snake. And O'Sheen was backing away, saying, oh, I'm not having anything to do with this. I've done my bit. I've already put my foot on top of it. And Pat said, well, I haven't. I need to. And he literally leapt into the air and came down thundering onto this snake and pushed his foot back and forwards on top of the adder. And then when he lifted his boot back up, there was nothing on the ground. There's literally just gravel. And I said, Pat, I think it's stuck to the bottom of your foot. And he went into this Irish jig as fast as possible, shaking his leg, and eventually the snake flopped off the bottom of his boot back onto the track, well and truly dead at this point. Apologies to the snake, but we walked on with quite a spring in our step at that point. It was a humorous encounter, but at the same time, it was very significant for each of us, particularly for Pat.
And I think just prior to this incident, you were also talking about a scripture passage about crushing the serpent's head.
Yeah, there was a lot of chat going back and forwards about the significance of prayer. I was blown away that I was a little bit nervous to bring this up with these two guys. I didn't know where they were at faith-wise. Certainly not everyone that walks the Camino de Santiago is going there for faith reasons. So I was quite ecstatic that they were not only willing to pray, but they then wanted to enthusiastically talk about prayer and to talk about certain scripture passages absolute blessing on my day and on that particular week to meet these guys.
Now, there was a moment when you were in the US and you were really looking forward to a good night's rest, as I'm sure you did on most of those 568 nights.
Yes.
Now, you were sitting in this bar and you had this strong sense that you had to keep going, that you had to listen to God, that God would provide. Mm. Tell us a bit about that encounter.
I should point out I wasn't sitting in a bar drowning my sorrows. I was sitting in a bar eating a counter meal at the time with my hot chocolate.
Thanks for that clarification.
But it was the only place in this particular little town in Wyoming in the USA that I could actually get a meal, tiny little place. It was minus 22 degrees Celsius at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I arrived in the town. My water supply had frozen solid, and from that town to the next town of Casper, it was 148 kilometres. There was nothing in between. According to my map, there were no towns. There was nowhere to restock my food and water supply. The locals were all telling me it was going to be 3 days' worth of walking to get to the other side of this basin, which was 1,000 metres above sea level, with mountains rising another 1,500 metres around that. Minus 22 in the daytime, you can imagine what it gets to at nighttime. And I'm supposed to put my tent out in this, and my water supply is frozen solid. So effectively, I've got 3 days of worth of walking. So I might get 2.5 days off frozen water supply. So it wasn't looking particularly good. And yet while I'm sitting there eating my dinner in this pub, honestly felt like God was just asking me to trust him, that overwhelming sense of trust me. I'd been through so much to get to that point. And there were many other occasions. All the locals were telling me at this stage, and these were faith-filled people. These were not just, it wasn't just secular society. This is a very faith-filled community. And they're talking about it from a Christian perspective, saying you've got a long way to carry this mission yet. It's a very important mission. Don't risk it. You don't need to prove anything. There's no one out there to carry this mission to. Your mission's about prayer, not walking. And that was true. It was about prayer, not walking. So they're saying, take the bus. Get the bus into Casper and walk on from there where the conditions are going to be more favourable. And there were plenty of times before this when I had taken the bus when it was too dangerous. And so I agreed with them. I was going to take the bus. But then that overwhelming sense that God was asking me to trust him, I went to bed very early and I got up at about 4 a.m. the next morning. There was a howling wind blowing outside. So it was I think the actual temperature was minus 18 at dawn, but the wind chill factor was dragging that down to somewhere between minus 25, minus 30. And I slipped out of the little hotel I was in before anyone could stop me, dropped my key off and off I went. Bitterly cold. I had a balaclava and beanie and jacket, and it still wasn't enough. So I actually pulled the towel I carried out of my backpack and wrapped that around my face as well, just so that I could breathe. The air at that temperature, simply to breathe it in will freeze your lungs within 30 seconds or start to freeze your lungs within 30 seconds. And after 10 to 15 minutes, you'll pass out through lack of oxygen. So, you know, you get frostbitten within 60 seconds. Your skin begins to freeze. So everything covered up. And as I headed off from this little town, the next 148 kilometres over 3 days looked exceedingly daunting. My water supply froze, I think, within the first hour. And yet I walked out the other side. Everything fitted into place. Random Christians rocked up in the middle of Shirley Basin out there, not knowing that I was out there, and always happened to be in possession of exactly what I needed at the time.
Was this the instance with the peanut butter craving?
It was. This was. This is funny. This is not so much what I needed at the time. It was what I wanted. And as I was walking down across Shirley Basin on the second day, late in the afternoon, I had a craving for peanut butter, and I don't know why. It just happens occasionally. And a white pickup came rumbling down the road in the other direction. I'd already met this guy earlier that morning. He'd passed me by. I was severely dehydrated at that time, and he happened to be carrying exactly what I needed in the form of a massive bottle of Gatorade, which he threw out the window to me. And he was on his way home, and he pulled over and said, "Sam, I wanted to get you something when I was up in Casper." He said, "I figured I'd pass you on the way back through this afternoon." He said, "No idea what you wanted, so I bought you a heap of Reese Buttercups." Now, I'd never seen them before. I didn't know what they were. They weren't in Australia when I left in 2006. And so I just thanked him and shook his hand and we parted company. And I walked on down the road and bit into my first Reese Buttercup and only then discovered that they were chocolate cupcakes filled with peanut butter. So literally threw both hands in the air and said, yes, had my peanut butter and devoured a lot of them. Felt very sick about 10 minutes later once I had finished all the Reese Buttercups. So it was amazing. Look, God provided for not just what I needed, but at times there was that extra little comfort along the way. Please don't get the impression that it was comfortable, though. I ended up with a really bad chest infection, mild hypothermia, and my big toe split open for the second time on that particular crossing, and it did require surgery about a week later. And that felt like a cigarette lighter was on underneath my foot as that wound split more and more. So on a very difficult journey, God provided the what I needed to make it out the other end and a little bit of comfort as well.
Now, Sam, in your journey, it was, I think, Central America, you're in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Adolfo, how you met him, how it changed you, and how it touched you.
Okay, so the background to this is that when I started walking for unity, for me, unity was all about the churches agreeing with each other, or Christians agreeing on what it is to be Christian, what it is to follow Christ, that we'd be one church theologically. We're not the church of Pontius Pilate saying, what is truth? Truth matters. I had, however, missed a substantial part of what it is to be united, that being love. It's not just about agreeing with each other. In fact, the more significant aspect is to love one another. And the moment that really set it off for me was meeting Adolfo in Panama. Adolfo he wasn't homeless. He was living in a tin shed with a dirt floor, no water, no toilet, no bathroom.
No electricity,
no door across his doorway. It was basically a woodshed, but that's what he, his wife, and his seven-year-old daughter lived in. And they slept in hammocks slung from the ceiling to keep away from wild animals at nighttime. They were probably 100, 150 metres away from the small village that they associated with. Anyway, Adolfo gave me accommodation that night. No one in the village would talk to me, and I assumed that it was because I was a white guy. I had copped a lot of racial abuse, so I thought that was why no one would even shake my hand. But at the end of the night, when I arrived there, I was left sitting on a log trying to figure out what I was going to do that night for accommodation and a meal I hadn't eaten. And Adolfo came up and introduced himself and asked if I needed somewhere to sleep that night. And he took me back, introduced me to his wife, and his daughter was quite... actually quite cute and kept snuggling into Dad, but then trying to ask questions. They didn't speak a word of English, so it was all down to my very poor Spanish to communicate. He asked me if I needed something to eat for dinner, and I could see that there's no fridge, there's no pantry, there are no shelves with food on it, but I was very hungry. I'd walked 41 kilometres to get there. I hadn't had dinner. I figured he might have a stash of rice around there somewhere, so I just said to him, look, I realise you don't have that much here, but yes, I am hungry. Anything you've got would be great, please, but I don't need much. And he ran back up into the village and went door knocking and came back 10 minutes later with half a bread roll and a slice of sausage on it, gave me that to eat for dinner. And the next morning over breakfast, his wife and daughter had gone back to the village, leaving Adolfo and I to have breakfast together. And over breakfast, I asked him, I can't remember exactly what the question was, but it was something about his wife and daughter. It was a fairly innocuous question, but he just started crying. And it turned out that the next day he was leaving his wife and daughter. He hadn't told them yet. He was still trying to figure out how he would tell them. He confided in me that the night before when he went to get me some food, he was asking for 4 bread rolls because they hadn't had dinner either. So you know, I was only able to secure 1 bread roll, which is the one he gave me. So they'd gone to bed without food, which put into context his daughter crying when they went to bed a little bit better. And he shared with me that he had moved to that village 6 months earlier because his parents-in-law lived in the village. They moved there to be closer to them. But he said because he hadn't been born in the village, no one would talk to him. I'd already made some sort of reference to the fact that no one would talk to me because I was a gringo. And he said, no, he said, it's not because you're a gringo. He said, it's because you're not one of them. And in this village, if you're not one of them, you're never one of them. He said, no one will talk to me. He said, you're the first guy I've had a conversation with in 6 months. He said, I can't find any work here. And because of that, I can't buy food for my family. He said, I have to leave in order to find work. He said, I'm going to go to Panama City, which was 200 kilometres away. He said, yeah, I haven't told my wife yet that I'm going, but he said, I have to leave so that they can eat. And he said, I'm getting the bus in the morning. I'll go down there and I'll find work wherever I can. And as I make money, I'll send it home to my wife so that she can buy food. I asked him where he was going to sleep, and he just shrugged his shoulders and said, I'll sleep on the streets, I guess. But he said, I hope someone might invite me into their home to sleep like I invited you into mine. And he sent me on my way with his daughter's Dino doll attached to the side of my backpack, with his thumb rosary around Dino's head like a necklace, just so that I wouldn't forget him, so that I'd pray for him and pray that he'd find work when he got to Panama City. And Dino flicked into view every step all the way for the next 12,500 kilometres, all the way to Spain. Wow. So it was just extraordinary. It ripped me apart.
He had so little, yet he gave you a room somewhere. He gave you food when he and his children didn't have any, and he gave you some beautiful time and that parting gift.
And even when I left, I left him with the money I had in my wallet, which was enough to get him by for the first week, but felt extraordinarily tokenistic. The reality was that I could walk onto the next town and withdraw more money at an ATM. When I gave him the money, he thanked me and said, wait here, and he ran off and cut a length of sugar cane and attached that into the side of my backpack as sustenance for the day ahead. Quite extraordinary. And you know what, we have Adolfos around us everywhere. My brother is married to an Argentinian girl, and their family moved to Australia probably 15 years ago now. And we've got to know that family really well. They're a part of our parish down in Launceston. And they were saying when they first arrived in Launceston, they went to the same mass every week and no one said hello to them for the first year. They said they were so lonely in their first year because everyone else had their own circles. And they weren't actively pushing them out as this village was with Adolfo, but almost through apathy, we just weren't inviting these people into our circles. We were all highly embarrassed to find out that they had been there for a year without anyone saying hello. So there's plenty of Adolfos around us. We certainly don't have to go to Central America to find them.
No.
I have, however, been back. I managed to save enough money and headed back to South America last year.
So did you find him? What happened?
Am I allowed to tell you? A guy came across and filmed it. A guy called Daniel Saban from Transverb Media came across, and it's now been made into a documentary. It's a four-part documentary, and that'll be made available probably the beginning of next year. It's called The Road to Adolfo. We actually went back to Venezuela first and travelled 1,000 kilometres across Venezuela first, trying to track down and meet people who I'd met on the initial walk who had played a significant role in the journey. And we did that because there was no guarantee we'd ever find Adolfo. So if this guy wants to make a documentary, well, you can't just come and film me walking around aimlessly asking people, do you know this guy, and them saying no. So we went back to Venezuela first. Eventually, we made it across into Panama. We went back to the village. No one knew of him. I had a photograph of him. No one remembered him. Didn't know his name. I told them where the house was. They said there's no house there. Eventually we walked down there, and sure enough, we found the collapsed house and had been burnt out. No one living there. It all looked like a complete loss. I will tell you how it ended though. We ran into...
Spoiler alert. If you're wanting to get the DVD series, it is going to be available for schools or for purchase.
Or for private, yep.
So spoiler alert.
Yes, and hopefully be on EWTN as well. So if you have EWTN, hopefully be able to watch it there later or in the middle of next year.
Fantastic.
It isn't really a spoiler alert because it's still quite incredible how it all came together. But we ran into a woman who we showed the photograph for, and she happened to be Adolfo's sister-in-law. And she managed to track him down for us. So we found Adolfo, and the incredible thing, I won't talk about how we actually found him and what actually happened, but whilst interviewing him, I recounted him leaving his village to come to Panama, and I asked him about that and why he had left, the circumstances surrounding it, and apparently he had told me exactly why he was leaving, but I didn't, my Spanish was poor, and I didn't know the Spanish word for pregnant. That's why he was leaving. His wife was pregnant. She'd been told if she didn't get food soon, she'd lose the child. And that's why he was so upset. And he was leaving that village to save his unborn child's life.
Wow.
And so when we found Adolfo, we found him with his wife and his two daughters. So extraordinary. And what was, sorry, another spoiler alert. What was extraordinary was that the unborn daughter from 2007, who's now 5 years old, knew who I was, because Mum and Dad had told her the story about the night before when Dad was leaving to save her life, how this massive white guy had suddenly appeared in the village and given Dad the money that he needed for the weeks ahead. He was able to stretch that money out, and he left some of the money with his wife so that they could buy food in the meantime. And thankfully, he was able to find work, a very generous Catholic family, knowing that this guy was searching for work in order to help his family. They said, look, we don't have work, but if you come to our place on Saturday, you mow the lawns, wash the car, we'll give you some money. And he's been doing that for 5 years.
Great. I'm so glad to hear that he's okay, and that's a beautiful...
And there's a lot more to the story. You have to wait for the documentary, but there's a lot more to it than just that.
Excellent.
But it was extraordinary.
Wow. Now, a lot of your accounts from your walk have been collated and put together in a book that's being published by Garrett Publishing. For people that are listening, it's called Walk for One, Paving a Path to Unity. Now, if people would like to get a hold of this book, I believe they can go to garrettpublishing.com.au.
Yes, or they can go to walkforone.com, and you'll also see links on that. So Walk for One, by the way, is W-A-L-K, the number 4-O-N-E. walkforone.com, and there are links through to the book there.
Excellent.
By the way, the book took longer to write than the journey took to walk. So obviously I walk faster than I write, but it was a long, long, long process getting that book done. Obviously with everything else that I've just talked about going on as well. So I was very pleased to be able to hand that final manuscript over and for it to go to the print house.
Now, this book, it's not just a travel account. Tell us a bit about the format of the book and its alternative purposes, other than just to read and be inspired by your story.
Garrett Publishing took the book on because they specialise in educational material. And what they saw in this particular story was an opportunity to reach out to students in particular. There are a lot of high schools already that have the Walk for One as a part of their curriculum when they're year 9s and 10s. Look at unity or look at different ways of expressing Christianity. They often direct their students towards Walk for One. And at the moment, there aren't really any resources. They go to the website. I usually know when a school is doing the students are doing their projects, because I suddenly get inundated with emails from students basically asking me to do their assignment for them. So I don't quite go to that extent. I give them a few answers and let them do the work for themselves. But Garrett Publishing thought this was a wonderful opportunity to actually provide a resource. So the book itself doesn't stand alone. They've also produced, through another author, a school resource package that schools can purchase to assist them to unpack the book. So instead of having to read the whole book, it's broken up. The resource package is broken up into faith-based areas, political areas, environmental issues. They look at what prayer is. They look at social justice issues. They really break it down and go through different parts of the book. So it certainly becomes for the students a very different way of reading the book. Instead of just in chronological order, they're reading it thematically.
Okay. And there's an educator's guide also available for teachers.
Yes.
Excellent. Yep. So homeschoolers, if they were interested for their teenage kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So Garrett Publishing have the lot, and I've been told that they're doing a deal where they basically, if a certain amount of books are purchased with the Educator's Guide, they give the Educator's Guide free of charge. So particularly for any homeschoolers, if you have a number of families who are interested, I think it was 10 copies, then they'd throw in the Educator's Guide free of charge.
Well, for our listeners, we can put the details of Garrett Publishing and Walk for One on the website at the end of the interview if you didn't have a pen handy.
That was adventurer, speaker and author Sam Clear. For more information about Sam and his work, visit walkforone.com. And for more talks, programs and interviews, visit cradio.org.au. cradio.org.au.